Thanks very much, Bill. To give a quick overview of my speech today, I'll just borrow from a recent video produced by our hosts, Westpac, which some of you may have seen. So the foreign exchange market is as simple as A plus B equals C, but maybe that's a bit complex for foreign exchange traders. So let me make it really simple and talk in a slow, condescending voice. The FX market is like the banana market. Got visual prop too. I'll just hang that there just so people in Westpac know what a banana is. There's this been this big bad storm in financial markets for the past 2 years. It huffed and puffed and blew over some houses like Lehman's, although apparently the financial market crisis was all caused by governments allowing banks to fail. I learnt that from listening to the video too. And like banana trees being flattened in the storm, the price of foreign exchange got more expensive during the storm, and the bid ask went up. Now the storm has passed, the price has come back down, just like bananas. But enough of the banana references, otherwise the offshore investors in the audience will think Australia is becoming a banana republic. Anyhow, enough of the levity. So in this speech, I will describe how the FX market has operated through the recovery in financial markets that we've seen over the past 9 months or so, and discuss some of the movements in the Aussie dollar, which has traversed a range of almost 40 cents against the US dollar just in the past 12 months. In recent months, intraday volatility in the market has declined, liquidity in the spot market has clearly improved, and the use of central bank swap lines has diminished considerably, and in our case, the swap line has actually been completely unwound. Despite these improvements, some traces of the crisis still remain. For example, foreign exchange turnover remains well below its pre-crisis levels. So this data here is collected by the six largest financial centres, including Australia, on FX turnover, and just shows you the evolution of that through the crisis. So you can see that there's been a reversal of the rapid growth in FX turnover that had been in place since the start of the decade. Turnover fell by nearly 25% from its peak to be around US dollars 2.3 trillion a day in April, a level of turnover which had been previously seen back in 2006. The fall in foreign exchange turnover has been broad-based right around the globe, reflecting the global nature of the crisis. Unsurprisingly, though, the largest falls in turnover were in the US and the UK, reflecting their role as the dominant financial centres. As you can see on the right-hand side of that chart, on both panels, that the turnover has actually fallen across all types of foreign exchange instruments. However, turnover in swaps and more exotic derivative markets declined earlier than the spot and the forward markets. And this difference may be explained in terms of the uses, risks, and complexity of the different types of instruments. So the decline in FX swap turnover coincided with the sharp decrease in cross-border investment flows. So what we've got here is just adding up the gross numbers of global cross-border capital movements. You can see they fell from 20% of world GDP in 2007 to less than 10% of GDP in 2008. Which obviously, so that drop in cross-border investment capital flows was reflected in a drop in swap turnover. There was also obviously heightened concerns about counterparty risk, which contributed to the drop in turnover. Two key users of FX swaps are banks and hedge funds. By October 2008, deleveraging by hedge funds was well underway, reducing their need to use swaps, and with the heightened counterparty risk, non-US banks, particularly European banks, were having increasing difficulty using swaps to fund US dollar positions. They had long US dollar positions, often at quite long maturities in what has subsequently turned out to be fairly toxic assets, which they were funding short as those sources of funding dried up, they often turned to the swap market to try and fund those US dollars. So turnover in derivatives such as cross-currency interest rate swaps has also fallen since April 2008. That market is of particular interest in Australia because of the role that foreign currency debt raisings play in Australian bank funding, and the use of cross-currency swaps to translate that foreign currency back into Australian dollars, which is actually what the banks need to lend into the local market. Just recently, the ABS put out the results of its latest hedging survey, which was paid for by us, the Reserve Bank, showing that the banks continue to hedge almost all of their foreign currency debt liabilities, with cross-currency interest rate swaps, the primary derivative instrument used to do this. So what I show here, and this we'll be publishing a write-up of this in our bulletin on next Thursday, shows the effective foreign currency position of Australia. So if you look there, you can see that about half of our foreign currency liabilities, or a bit under half, are actually in foreign currency, but then the bulk of them are actually hedged back into Aussie. So actually, if you take into account hedging, Australia is actually net long foreign currency, whereas if you look at the unhedged position, it looks like the country is net short foreign currency. So once you take taking into account hedging makes a sizable difference to the foreign currency exposure of Australia as a whole. In contrast to many other markets, though, turnover in the spot market actually increased between April and October 2008. So what I'm showing here is more high-frequency data than the chart I showed you at the beginning. This is data we collect in the local market on a monthly basis from the banks, looking at turnover. And it actually has bounced off the bottom in the last few months. This is probably, what you can see from April to October has actually increased through some of the worst of the crisis. That's probably explained by an increase in demand as customers sought to adjust positions in response to the flood of news and events surrounding the collapse of Lehman's and the associated increase in volatility. So that peak in spot turnover is actually October 2008, about the height of the crisis. The subsequent fall in spot turnover since October 2008 is therefore due in part to a reduction in volatility and slower rate of news flow. However, an additional driver behind the slowdown that you can see from October 2008 is that large collapse in trade that we saw in the last quarter of last year. So spot and forward turnover, as you can see in the graph here, have generally moved in line with gross trade flows over the past couple of decades, and as trade collapsed in that final quarter of 2008, so did spot turnover. Looking forward, one positive sign for spot turnover is that gross trade has actually been picking up since April, and our more timely data shows that there is indeed a pickup in spot turnover. Sorry, that's the global. So that's the orange line there. In the middle, you can see in the last couple of months has actually bounced off those lows. Lower turnover in the foreign exchange market does not appear to be linked to any problems with the market, with market function. Indeed, I would say throughout the financial crisis, the foreign exchange market probably performed almost better than any other market. Liquidity has improved in the spot market over recent months, with the bid-ask spread currently approaching pre-crisis levels. So what I show here is the bid-ask spread on a few currency pairs. The Aussie-US is in purple, US CAD as a benchmark against the Aussie is in yellow, and then sterling US in light blue. And you can see the rise in the bid-ask spreads through the worst of the crisis in all three of those currency pairs, with the rise being particularly pronounced in Aussie and CAD. So, but you can also see there that the bid-ask spread has narrowed again, and it's back down to around 2 cents, or 2.5 cents in our case, from a peak of around 0.02 cents, from a peak of around 0.07. So that there clearly is an improvement there, although the market is prone to the sporadic bouts of volatility and reduced liquidity even in recent times. So if you go back to 2008 particularly around October, where that sort of peak in the bid-ask spread, clearly the market was having bouts of fairly extreme illiquidity. So at that time, risk retrenchment and the unwinding of leverage positions in the market were generating one-sided markets. As an example, particularly in Australia, one group of participants that we, at least from our market liaison, that was contributing to the one-sided markets were fund managers, domestic Australian fund managers, some of whom may be in this room, adjusting their foreign currency hedges on their foreign equity investments. So the survey, which I mentioned earlier on hedging, found that Australian investors hedge around half of their currency risk on their foreign portfolio equity investments. So as global equity markets fell sharply late last year, the size of those hedges that they had in place became too large relative to the value of the underlying equity portfolio. So in order to correct the hedge, fund managers needed to sell Aussie either in the spot or forward market. Although that sort of adjustment is going on all the time as equity markets move around, the extent of the falls in equity markets meant that those flows were much larger than usual around the third and fourth quarter last year, and the trades were obviously being executed in the much thinner markets. And so a lot of the trades we saw coming through the market in sort of particularly September, October 08 were trades associated with hedge adjustment. So in that environment, the bank, us, Reserve Bank, entered the market to support liquidity and reduce the size of the gaps in the exchange rate that occurred as the large Australian dollar flows, particularly related to hedging, were digested by the interdealer market. Our interventions at the time weren't designed to target any particular level of the exchange rate, but rather to enhance the functioning and particularly the liquidity in the market. So net sales of foreign exchange by us in the market totaled around about just under $3.5 billion in October and November. Because of the nature of the transactions that were going through the market, the size of our individual transactions were actually very small, in fact as small as we've ever seen them really, or seen them in any recent times, in contrast to our intervention in the market in 2001 where we tended to intervene in very large size. As I go on to discuss, since its trough in March, the Aussie has appreciated to be well above its long-run average on both a trade-weighted basis and against the US dollar, and with market conditions normalising and liquidity improving, the bank has therefore taken the opportunity to replenish the reserves that were deployed during that episode. In fact, we've fully replenished the reserves that were deployed during that episode. So let me now turn to talk a little more explicitly about the currency. So as I said earlier, the Australian dollar has traded for a very large range over the past year or so, so basically from 60 cents to 98.5 cents. The forces that were behind last year's sharp depreciation have retreated in the face of the coordinated global response to the financial crisis, and many of those forces are now actually working strongly in reverse. So on a trade-weighted basis, the Aussie is only around 5% below the peak seen in July 08. And the rebound in the Aussie has been particularly rapid if you compare it to the recovery in other markets that have benefited from the improved outlook. In fact, the rise in the Aussie is about the largest rise of any asset. In broad terms, the behaviour of the Aussie dollar over the past 18 months can be explained by the large swings we've seen in risk aversion and expectations about economic fundamentals. A lot of people like to explain what was going on, particularly in September and October 2008, as a flight to quality and a flight out of risky assets. I don't find that a particularly useful way of characterising things. I mean, to some extent, there was certainly a flight to liquidity in terms of US treasuries, but if you think about it, would you characterise an investment in Japanese government bonds or US Treasury as the highest quality investment out there at the moment versus, say, investing in a very profitable institution like Westpac? So I would rather characterise what was going on as repatriation flows and particularly an increase in home bias. The Aussie is often described as a commodity currency, meaning there's been a historically strong relationship between the Aussie and the terms of trade and commodity prices. You see some evidence of it here. So as a result, over the past 18 months, the Aussie has been particularly sensitive to the large and rapid changes in expectations for world growth that have occurred. So one way to demonstrate this is to look at the evolution of IMF forecasts for the world since 2008. So just prior to the collapse of Lehman Brothers, world growth forecasts were around 4% for this current year, for 2009. By April this year, expectations for 2009 for the world have been revised down below zero. So the forecast for the world for 2009 in April that the IMF put out was for negative growth, compared to 4% in as recently as August last year. The latest forecast, which they just put out, now put average growth in 2010 at around 3%, a significant improvement on 6 months ago. So it turns out that April was the peak of pessimism in terms of the outlook for the world, which was, as you can see, where the Aussie was around about at its trough. So the other key factor behind the fall and subsequent rise of the Aussie has been fluctuations in risk aversion. And risk aversion obviously took on a special importance for financial markets last year, with the VIX, which is often used indicator of risk aversion, reaching 20-year highs. And that heightened risk aversion certainly contributed to the depreciation of the Aussie last year. Investors worldwide were on net repatriating their holdings of foreign assets as their risk aversion increased. That is, there was a marked increase, as I said earlier, in their home bias. So I think I would characterise what was going on as a flight home rather than as a flight to quality, or if you want, a flight to liquidity, and particularly in terms of invest into treasuries. So given that American and Japanese investors have the largest by volume of offshore investments, this saw the US dollar and the yen appreciate the most as that money was brought back onshore. As at home bias has abated and investors have rebuilt their offshore portfolios, the US dollar in particular has depreciated. In fact, my sense now is that portfolios are roughly back to where they were in terms of risk about 18 months ago. I'm not sure that people are necessarily long risk at the moment, they're just back to square risk, however you want to characterise that. For Australia, this implied a slower rate of investment by foreigners, and the balance of payments data show there was an outflow of foreign private capital in the December quarter of 2008. So there was obviously a home retreat to home by Japanese and US investors. There was also a sizable repatriation of foreign portfolio investments by Australians throughout late 2008 and early this year. But because our relative size is a lot smaller, that was outweighed by the flows going the other direction. On top of that, highly leveraged investors, mostly located overseas, particularly hedge funds, were forced to liquidate portfolios that generally, well, that often included Australian dollar investments as their losses mounted in other parts of their portfolio. This pressure to liquidate was exacerbated by the need of those funds to reduce their liquidity, reduce their leverage. Furthermore, the hedging transactions I described earlier by Australian fund managers added to the downward pressure on the currency. The more the currency depreciated, the more those hedges had to be readjusted, which added further to the downward pressure on the currency. So we have basically had a downward spiral going on there, exacerbated by the thinness of the market. As the currency is subsequently appreciated, that whole process has gone into reverse, actually. So that's contributed to the upward pressure on the currency over the last 6 months or so. At the height of the crisis, the Australian dollar was often also used as a proxy for trading in other currencies. Because the Australian dollar is traded in all time zones in a relatively liquid market, traders were able to adjust positions in other less liquid or non-globally traded currencies. So, for example, the Australian dollar was reportedly used as a proxy for trades in the Korean won during New York trading hours, when the won isn't traded, and similarly, during Asian trading hours, it was used as a proxy for the Brazilian real when the real isn't traded. So liquidity is generally a good thing, but sometimes you have to be careful what you wish for. The link between the Australian dollar and the global investors' fluctuating attitude towards risk is reflected in the strong increase in the correlation between the Aussie and equity industries global equity industries from the middle of last year. So what I've got here is just the correlation between the Aussie, movements in the Aussie, and movements in Asian equity industries in light blue, and the S&P 500 in purple. We showed a graph, I think, in one of our earlier monetary policy statements this year. If you look at the correlation between the Aussie and the S&P 500 in the last hour of trading in New York through the height of the crisis, the correlation's basically one, although you could pick a few other assets where that was true too. So large movements up in the S&P, Aussie goes up, large movements down, Aussie goes down. What is interesting, though, is that the correlation has actually remained high since the start of the year, even as market conditions have improved. So it suggests that the perceived reduction in risk has been an important force in driving the appreciation of the Aussie since March. And looking at the balance of payments data again, there have been large net inflows of foreign capital into Australia since the start of the year as the home bias of global investors has eased. The Australian dollar carry trade now also appears to be back in vogue, and while it's difficult to find concrete data on the absolute size of carry positions, there are two sources of data which we can use as indicators of potential carry trade activity. One is the net position of speculative, or so at least self-labeled speculative futures traders at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, and the other is the net position of Japanese retail investors. As you can see, both these groups of traders have been increasing the size of their net long positions in the Aussie since the start of the year. The Australian interest differential has clearly remained relatively high relative to most other currency pairs, and the recent appreciation of the Australian dollar has seen Aussie yen simple carry trade returns, ignoring the transaction costs, of almost 30% since the start of the year. Although we published some research earlier in the year which showed that even if you'd made a large amount of returns on that trade over a number of years, you pretty much got wiped out at the third or fourth quarter of last year. So again, you have to be, if you can time it right, very profitable, but if you don't, very costly. Given the roles that world growth expectations and risk aversion have played in driving movements in the Aussie recently, it's not surprising that a large part of the depreciation and subsequent appreciation that has occurred over the past 18 months has been happening during the overnight session. So that's another way we look at what goes on as we break down the movement in the Aussie between what happens in the offshore session and what happens during the Aussie session. So we've just the orange line is the total movement in the currency. The purple line is what's happening during the Australian trading day. And the light blue line is what's happening in the offshore trading. And so you can see there the large gyrations have tended to be in the offshore. The bulk of the movement in the currency has been explained by movements in the offshore session. In fact, and as you can see there, the Aussie has basically traded broadly sideways during the local session since the start of the year. If we went back a couple of years earlier, we would have found that most of the movement in the currency was occurring during the local trading day rather than the offshore day. So let me just wrap up by saying the past 2 years have obviously seen major disruptions to many financial markets, but by and large, I'd say the foreign exchange market has tended to function better than most other markets. Now, there were obviously periods of extreme illiquidity, but relative to other markets, I think it was considerably less. Turnover in many foreign exchange instruments has declined to be well below previous peaks, but again, more recently, we've seen turnover increasing. The Australian dollar has moved for a wide range, in part reflecting large portfolio adjustments by global investors. As I said, we saw a large increase in home bias through the second half of last year and into March this year, and a large reversal in that increase in home bias since March this year. But through all that, the movement in the exchange rate has once again proven to be an important means of assisting the Australian economy adjust to changes in the global economic environment. As on earlier occasions when the exchange rate has provided this important adjustment mechanism, the economy has proven to be very resilient to those swings. So with that brief recap of the FX market, let me finish there. And as Bill said, I'm happy to take any questions that people might have. So it was more a question of if you were used as an intraday proxy. So what would happen would be when the Asian markets are shut, the won isn't traded at all in the US. So the Aussie is continuing trading there. Well, you know that when the Asian markets open again, the won's going to gap. So you use the Aussie as a hedge in your portfolio against that movement, which otherwise would be occurring in the won, but isn't because the market's shut. Well, it's not traded. And as I said, same opposite for the real, which isn't traded during the Asian trading day. So it was more just in terms of an intraday hedge, not any sort of anything at a longer horizon than that. But it served to increase the volatility and the size of trades coming through this market and the volatility.
Thanks, Guy. I'm Dale Bridle from Fairfax Media. Are you concerned about the size of the global carry trade? And do you think the potential unwinding might have a significant impact on currency valuations?
Thanks. I actually have a footnote in my speech that I didn't read out, which sort of related to that. So I think what people mean by carry trade, it seems to vary commentator by commentator. A lot of people characterize, as mentioned, that if a US investor or a Japanese investor invest in a high-yielding asset offshore rather than put their money on deposit and get 0% in their home country, a number of commentators call that a carry trade. I just call that investment. And so those investment flows certainly swing around, as I talked about earlier. But so by carry trade, I would tend to think more in terms of, I think leverage has got to be involved somewhere or another. I don't know that... it's not something that... I suppose we're particularly worried about. It's something we pay a lot of attention to. I'm not sure in terms of whether it actually generates a huge degree of worry. I mean, as I said, we've seen these large, we've seen decent fluctuations in the currency, which haven't caused us great concern. I'm not sure that there's a huge amount of it going on out there at the moment. I mean, is it increasing? Yes, it certainly is. But I'm not sure it's as large as some commentators would have you believe right at the moment. From our point of view, it's not so much of a concern. As you said, if it reverses in a hurry, that can be a cause for concern. I mean, the other issue, which I think, was more a concern for the Japanese authorities, was with a lot of Japanese retail investors investing with leverage on the assumption that the Aussie yen only ever moved in one direction. They found out around July, August last year, that isn't the case. And a lot of them got wiped out very quickly. They seem to be starting to come back into the market now. So, from an investor education point of view, it's as much a concern as it is from our side. I mean, we, we published some research on this, I think, sometime in the past 12 months. And one thing you note, you can actually see it in the turnover data, is there's a spike at around 9 a.m. and a spike at around 6 p.m. in trading in Aussie yen, which is when the Japanese... So Mrs. Watanabe, who's the stereotypical carry trade investor in Japan, would come, take the kids to work, husband's gone off to work, put on the carry trade at 9 a.m. in the morning, go about her day, come back, husband comes home, takes off carry trade at 6 p.m. in the evening. So you'd have these big spikes in intraday turnover. So, which was very profitable for them for quite some time, but as I said, got wiped out very quickly in a short space of time.
Andrew Gill from GTS Fund. I may be paraphrasing you incorrectly, but I think you said US Treasuries weren't a safe investment.
No, I didn't say that. Okay. No one heard that.
Words to that effect.
I said they were very liquid. I said they were very liquid investments. No, all I meant was that people, that we're normally on the receiving end of this. So we're always a flight. We're always a flight from quality, right? So everyone says flight to quality when Aussie's going down, which always implies that therefore we're not quality. So it was more a slight jibe at that.
If they're not the same quality as the Australian dollar, why aren't they that quality? I mean, do you?
I don't. You're an investor. You tell me.
You're the debt governor. You tell me.
No, I've not.
Could you just speak broadly about them and whether you see the current level as appropriate or how you see
of treasuries?
Yes.
But I mean, given the expectations for interest rates, it's hard to say otherwise. But I don't really want to comment on level of bond yields. But I mean, there was obviously a shift. As I said, what I was trying to say was, rather than characterising it as a flight to or from quality, I think it's much better to think about it in terms of risk aversion, home bias, and describing it that way. Treasuries had that particular, you know, in the end, they at the height of illiquidity in global markets in October, U.S. Treasury on the run, U.S. Treasuries were basically the only liquid market left in the world, and so they were clearly the most liquid market in the world. And so when risk aversion is at its height, liquidity is at a premium, funds will tend to flow to the most liquid investment, and that was and still remains US Treasuries.
Sure, thank you.
Robert Rennie from Westpac. Guy, I'll ask an easier question here. You mentioned a number of times this month-end fixing process. Do you think we've built a system now, a complex financial system that relies too much on limited liquidity windows, you know, over a short period of time, for instance, at month end in London, excuse me, you know, is there too much of the fund management community chasing that liquidity once a month and potentially adding to volatility in currencies like the Australian dollar?
I don't know, it's a high, I mean, the institutional arrangements have evolved that way. You know, as if you were talking about the hedges earlier, you know, ultimately, you know, people were still forcing through those hedge adjustments in the most illiquid markets because they had to stay very tightly to their mandates. It's more a question for people in this room, or, you know, and sometimes at huge cost making those adjustments. As you said, published some research which shows this. There's a spike in volatility around the time of the London fix, which everyone knows about, but still nevertheless is there. I mean, it just shows you, I think, I think amongst other things, it just shows you institutional frame or setups actually matter more than people often think. You know, particularly in a market like FX, which everyone thinks, you know, is generally regarded as being close to the smoothest adjusting, most liquid market out there, and you still have these developments which sort of reflect the institutional structure of the market. I'm not sure off the top of my head, I'm not sure I can say whether this is a good or a bad thing. I just it's an interesting, certainly from researching the market, it's an interesting phenomenon that these sort of things still exist and are not arbitraged away.
Bill Evans from Westpac. Guy. Guy, if we were to have a situation as 2010 evolves where the complacency that seems to be emerging with regard to the pace of recovery in the US and Europe and what's priced into share markets and that, if it turned out that there was some unfortunate shocks and that complacency was proved to be unjustified, the lesson from 2008 was that that would be a movement back into risk, away from risk assets, and the Australian dollar and such currencies would be adversely affected. Do you think there's a possibility of a structural change in that attitude if, for instance, you were seen to be well linked in with the growth region, that the Australian dollar was no longer seen to be the highly risk asset, or do you think the liquidity factors and the others you mentioned will still dominate?
Don't want to make a prediction on the currency, because our best prediction is the currency is whatever it is today. But I think that's a possibility, but it happened to some extent through until about July last year. So as I said, the currency peaked, the Aussie peaked in July 2008. Now, by that stage, we'd obviously had some, you know, there'd been a reasonable amount of financial shocks hitting the North Atlantic economies up to that point, and Asia had continued to be resilient up until that point. And so there had been some differentiation between Asian assets and North Atlantic assets. So by that I mean US, Europe, and the UK. And then that all broke down, obviously, in from September last year through until about March this year. The rebound we've seen from about March this year has been pretty consistent across all asset markets. And I think to some extent we're at that point where we'll find out which way we're going on that around about now. So as I said, I get the sense that portfolios are sort of roughly back to balance in terms of risk, and the question is, where do things go from here? Are you going to get that differentiation between with more portfolio flow coming into this part of the world, I mean Asia more generally, not just Australia, or so there is going to be a different, and into parts of Latin America, or is there going to be people shifting overweight into this part of the world? So to some extent I'm not sure I can really answer your question, but I think we'll sort of have a better sense of what the answer might be sometime over the next 6-9 months.
Excuse me, Guy. George from Hagemeyer Brands. Two-part question. The first one was, obviously, when we went down towards 60 cents, the Aussie-US last year, there was purchasing of, obviously, how are the Federal Reserve sort of stockpile of Aussie dollars at the moment with the appreciation of the dollar? Have they gone back to the similar level? And the second part was, is there a concern by the RBA in terms of this appreciation of the dollar, not just in inflation and interest rate pressures, but with the current account deficit, with imports becoming more, less expensive? So what's the concern? Is there a big concern there by the RBA on that?
No, on the first part of the question, as I mentioned during the speech, our reserves are back to where they were pre-intervention. So by July-ish this year, we'd repurchase the foreign exchange reserves that we'd utilised during the second half of last year. We have already done that. On the second part of your question, we don't look at the current account per se. I regard it as a completely endogenous variable, just happens to reflect whatever else is going on in the economy. So do we take the exchange rate into account in monetary policy setting? Yeah, we do, and it's been evident in the last few monetary policy press releases that is the case. So it obviously has an effect on the economy, and that's what we basically do think about it in terms of its effect on the outlook for growth and inflation. As I mentioned at the end of my speech, it's an important adjustment mechanism for the economy, so it's clearly something that we take into account and pay a reasonable amount of attention to.
Guys, it's Mark Hedges from OneSteel. Can you just expand a bit on the circumstances that the bank would use if you intervened in the currency?
Yeah, we actually, go into this in a little detail in our most recent annual report where we go through this. And there's a paper we put out in 2004 by Chris Becker and Mike Sinclair, which sort of goes through our modus operandi in terms of intervention. So just referring to that if you want to read about this in any more detail. But basically what we're doing is looking at the liquidity in the market. So when there was large gapping going on in the market, which can actually occur at any level. So we did some intervention in, get my years right, September 07, for instance, when the currency was clearly higher, again, because there was some gapping going on in the market then. And then obviously we intervened, well, not obviously, but we did intervene in September and October last year when there was considerable gapping going on the market. It was on top of my head, I think it was October the 8th. Should be able to remember this day, but the days got a bit blurred around that time. But October the 8th was a Friday. The currency against the US dollar, I think, moved through, or against the yen, it moved through a 17-figure range. Against the US dollar, it moved through a 12-figure range. And some of those figures were happening in the space of a minute or two. So, you know, there was a complete lack of liquidity in the market. As we were in there intervening in the market, and we were just not, there was no trading going on. I mean, we're basically sitting on one side of the market, pretty much the only person sitting on one side of the market, and just not getting hit, because there was just no one wanted to do anything at all except for these little dribs and drabs which were coming through. So that, I think, you know, that's a significant deterioration in market functioning. That's what we're trying to redress as best we can, is to improve that market functioning so that at least you've got a, you know, a market there, a two-sided market there, rather than a complete one-sided market. So it's basically all about, it's all about the market functioning nearly all the time, nothing, you know, which can actually occur at any level of the exchange rate. So it's, that's what I was trying to make the point in the speech. It's about providing the liquidity to the market. It's not about targeting any particular level in the exchange rate.
Yeah, hi, Richard Quinn, Credit Suisse. Guy, does it worry you to see the bills LIBOR spread blow out? Does that mean that we have very large funding requirements offshore? Like, is it some banks are maybe too large? They can't get their bananas when they need them.
No, but it's a, you mean the domestic bills OIS spread or the actual, or the bills LIBOR? I mean,
the bills LIBOR spread.
Yeah, I mean, I don't find, yeah, I mean, I'm not sure how relevant the, I'm never sure that, we don't pay a lot of attention to bills LIBOR, because I'm not sure that LIBOR is all that relevant for the banks. The basis swap, if that's what you're talking about, is, sorry, I may have just contradicted myself, but anyway, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, if the basis swap's wider, clearly that increases funding costs, but that's, you know, it's the same as in domestically, if bills OIS is wider, that also increases funding costs, or even the spread that people charge on debt is wider, that increases funding costs. So I just, it's part of the funding mix. It's a cost input into the funding mix. You know, obviously, if it's wider, funding costs are relatively higher. It's not, I mean, again, sort of like I said about the exchange rate, it's like, it is what it is. I'm not, you know, it's not something, you know, so I wouldn't say I worry about it. Do we pay attention to it? Yes. But it's not something I would say we worry about it. I mean, obviously, particularly the four major banks who use it a lot worry about it and try and work out where it's going, but to try and, you know, minimise their funding costs. But, you know, as I said, there are a bunch of elements which add up to funding costs, and of which that is one, and clearly an important one for offshore funding, but all of them been moving around in a wide range over the past couple of years. That one happens to be reasonably wide, or particularly wide at the moment. By the way, a phenomenon which is not unique to Australia. I mean, that spread is wide for any currency against the US dollar at the moment. It happens to be wider, has moved up more for us than it has for other currencies, but that's it. It's in part a global phenomenon with a bit of local flavour added on top.